song?
There's so much unwillingness to get in a vulnerable state with their dynamic. Like, they're so unwilling to get into conversations that are not beyond the surface that they cannot stop joking, it seems.
Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy.
Our Thoughts Tonight.
How goes it?
I am your host, Ringo Starr, and I am here with Zach.
How's it going?
How are you doing?
Pretty good.
All right, so this is a special edition of Our Thoughts Tonight. Tonight? Yeah.
Just the two of us.
Just the two of us. And what are we going to talk about today, Zach?
We're going to talk about the Beatles documentary by Peter Jackson called Get Back. It's a three-part documentary, and it had like over 150 hours and a lot more audio than that, but Peter Jackson whittled it down to like three parts. It's like 7+ hours or something like that. But yeah, that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
And last year, around this time, I think it was maybe a little bit later last year.
I think it was right after Christmas.
It was right after Christmas, like the 28th or something like that.
Yeah.
McCartney 3, Paul McCartney's solo album
McCartney
came out. And we did a review of that on Our Thoughts Tonight. And that, strangely enough, was our most popular episode.
Yeah, controversy, that's why.
Yeah, the controversy, because I did not give it a good review, that's for sure.
I liked it, but I didn't like it enough to listen to it again.
Yeah.
But that's a whole nother story on a later episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a past episode.
Past episode. Yeah. Go back and listen to it. It is pretty interesting. And Sean, our co-host that passed away.
Yeah, he was on
last earlier this year, was also on that one. So it's a great conversation.
Yeah.
But today we're going to be focusing on the Beatles' Get Back. Before that, as always, Crucem Sanctam.
Crucem Sanctam, Subit.
We are back on Our Thoughts Tonight, and we're going to be talking about the Get Back, the Beatles documentary that came out about a month ago or so now.
Yeah, I think it was a month ago.
Mm-hmm. And late November, I think, Disney Plus.
It was the first thing I came back to watch, I think, after Vegas.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's a good way.
I was like, badoo, first thing. I was like, oh, wow, this is awesome. This is the best thing I could possibly watch right now. Just like, usually you put things on to like numb your mind or whatever, but this was one of those films where you're just completely sucked in and everything's tuned out, and if you love the Beatles as much as we do, then your focal points are completely on the screen the whole time for 7+ hours.
Yeah, I was definitely paying attention to a lot of things that I wondered in terms of, you know, their process and their dynamics are between one another, and we'll get into that in a bit. Yeah. But you said you had a question.
Oh yeah. Let's kick it off like this. How would you rate the film from 1 to 10?
From 1 to 10, 10 being the best?
Yeah. 1 being the worst.
That's a tough one, yeah. From what perspective? Like, just in general?
Yeah, just in general. Or like a fan's perspective.
From a fan perspective,
Or like just watching the musical process of them writing songs, just like overall, though, that's what the question was. Like, would you rate the whole film?
Overall, I think it gets a, I would give it a 9 out of 10.
Yeah, that's what
nine
I was
out of 10.
I was gonna say, last time you're like, make the fuck out of here.
Yeah, with the McCartney 3. Yeah, that was the whole contentious point of that.
Yeah,
because you gave it like a 9 out of 10, and I was like, 9 out of 10?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, but I would give this a 9 out of 10 because there is, for one, the raw substance is there.
Yeah.
It was such a great time in music for them, even though it was like past their prime, arguably.
And in hindsight, Paul and Ringo thought that it was like the worst time. And I guess in some aspects after watching that film, you could see why. But I think they forgot about like how much fun they actually had. You know, but I feel like a lot of the problems that they had within the band was like Paul. like,
you think so?
But between the four of them.
Yeah.
Because, you know?
Yeah.
Like, George wanted to go and do his own thing. And then I think Ringo left briefly, too, for a little bit.
Yeah, he left during the White Album.
But you could see, like, on the first episode, it's not a bad thing either that Paul contributes so much. Mm-hmm. But you can see the contrast between all four of them and how much all of them have grown up and how all of them have their own outlooks on how they want to write songs. But because so many of them are creative in their own way and have their own style, that it's like butting heads with each other to try to fight to get their songs onto the album. But I feel like Paul got the most songs on the album still.
Absolutely.
And George got like two and John got like half as much as Paul.
But yeah, I agree. I think the reason what I was trying to say was like the substance is there, even though they might arguably be past their prime, but still, I don't know. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
I feel like it's healthy, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's what happens when you're in bands.
Yeah. What stood out to me was how functional they actually were.
Yeah.
How they all wanted to make it work.
Yeah.
For the most part. Even though George left.
Yeah.
He once he came back was all gung ho. They just wanted to make it happen. And then it was just a matter of agreeing on what they wanted to do, which is
was
shocking
terms.
To me because you could see like when they got in like a huddle, those guys were family for one another.
Yeah.
They were
brothers.
All they had. They grew up together, you know? So there was a real intimate and interpersonal relationship within them that I don't think anybody ever had seen in the past. Mm. Oh, I remember what I was going to say about why I gave it a 9 out of 10, because if you look at the Let It Be documentary, which uses parts of the same footage, it's complete garbage.
Yeah.
It's complete garbage.
I've never seen it.
It's bad.
Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say
it. They focus on that moment where George leaves and it's directed.
Oh, so they just drag it on.
Yeah.
The like 5 minute part that's in the three part documentary, they turn it into like an hour
out of all that footage. Yeah.
That's sad.
It's directed by Michael Lindsay Hogg. He's in the documentary quite a bit in both of the documentaries. That
I think he's on the rooftop too.
He's on the rooftop.
Oh, so he
had a lot of, I mean, he told the cameras like what to film and stuff.
Yeah.
So
he was like filming all the time.
Yeah.
And he was asking the band in the film, he's like, should we film this? And they're like, I think it was John. He's like, I don't even know why we're filming anymore. George isn't even here. He's like, are we even Beatles?
It's good that they filmed that, obviously. Yeah.
He's like, we're the Boodles.
So, yeah, I think it was good for that reason. What do you think out of 10, from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest?
I'd give it 9 out of 10,
9
too.
Out of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Agree.
The only reason why I give it 9 out of 10 and not 10 out of 10 is because, like, it's because like some of like the audio didn't match with the footage, but I understand why. Like that's a really, really hard thing to do. You would know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but taking someone else's work and going through like 150 something hours, you know, of a footage and audio on top of it and trying to match it and make it look presentable and have good transitions and make it flow the whole entire way, you know? Oh yeah. I have a question.
All right.
It ties into the question.
Okay.
It's do you think that the director Peter Jackson did a great job at editing the whole video and audio on the film?
I think he did about as good as you can get.
Yeah.
And not adding, what I liked is that there was no narrator. So there was no, voice of God there, and that they just used text for those moments.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was impressed with the most, which I actually took inspiration from my latest YouTube video, was when Paul is sitting there he's trying to come up with something, and he's like in the process of writing Get Back.
Yeah.
And you're watching him, and you're just like, oh, you just think it's Paul playing something, right?
Yeah.
Something arbitrary. But then the text comes up and it's like Paul is scrambling to come up with some material because they're running out of time.
Yeah, they got like 2 weeks to write 12 songs or something like that.
And he says something along the lines of, or the text says something along the lines of, what's about to take place is that Paul is about to write the next single for the Beatles.
Yeah.
And because he says that in the text, you know what's going to happen as you're watching it, but it builds suspense.
It builds, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, suspense.
It's really cool. I think that was an interesting thing. Like, just say what's about to happen, and we watch.
Yeah.
And your attention is grabbed immediately. I thought that was powerful.
Oh, yeah. It builds tension. That's what I was going to say.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, you're like, that's when you read that text. I don't know about you, but me, I was like, oh, my eyes were like glued to
the screen.
I was
like, oh, shit.
Anticipation.
Anticipation, yeah.
That's what I was like.
The way I used that in the most recent YouTube video was, if you do watch my YouTube, there's a moment where this is totally unrelated, but it's about how communism and the Red Scare and all that. So I say something along the lines of, after World War II, you know, things changed and America is about to enter one of the most controversial moments or one of the most controversial eras in its history.
Yeah.
So as I say that, you know, we watch the rest of the video is one of the most controversial eras in America's history.
Yeah.
And I got that exactly from the Get Back thing.
Yeah.
Like the phrasing and everything. I just changed what the topic was because it was so powerful to me. So I think he did a great job. Specifically, that moment, I think, was like that and the very end, how he built tension at the very end with the cops entering.
Oh, yeah. Paul's face.
Yeah.
But during a song, I think
that was so good.
Yeah, he like turns around and he just like goes up the microphone. He's like, "Woo!"
Yeah,
like it made me laugh. I feel like I've been in moments like that.
He knew he was like, "Oh shit, we're in trouble."
Yeah, he's like, "But they can't come on the roof. There's too much weight."
Yeah.
It's like we got a band up here and like 40 people up here,
and it's so good.
Another thing too is like, I like how when the cops arrived, they like didn't know what to do. And everyone that was in the recording studio, what is it called? Apple Records?
Yeah, it's...
It was funny to me that all the staff that work in the recording studio are just like, yeah, we don't know what's going on. Like they were just covering their backs.
They were playing, yeah. It was like, it was definitely orchestrated to some extent, you would think at least.
Yeah, I think it was.
Three Savile Row. Which is the rooftop of the building Apple Corp.
Okay, I was right. Yeah. But yeah, that was hilarious to me. And then when the cops finally do make their way up, they just end up standing there in the doorway, basically just watching the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're still alive to this day, and I wonder what their perspective is.
The guy, the main cop, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, the guy that was talking, he's like, you got to turn it down.
Yeah, they interviewed him, and he says... that he was just doing what he was supposed to do, and that he didn't enter there with any animosity.
Yeah.
And that he was just, you know, he didn't know what was going on, and he didn't enter there with any animosity. He just wanted to tell them, like, hey, look, there's people complaining. And he says he feels no remorse. Yeah. Like, he's like, I was just doing my job.
Yeah.
And they asked him if he liked the Beatles, and he said, yeah, I liked them. I didn't really like them during their Hare Krishna phase, but...
Yeah,
and he says in hindsight, like, yeah, he enjoys them and all that.
That's cool.
Yeah,
it's probably pretty historical for him.
Definitely. I mean, he's a part of it.
Yeah,
he's probably cool to see.
Yeah,
he's in his 70s now.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we have some more interesting questions and reviews about Get Back, the Beatles documentary.
We are back in the USSR.
On Our Thoughts Tonight. We're back talking about Get Back, the documentary. And I have a question for you, Zach.
What?
So we talked about the editing and we talked about...
The ranking.
Yeah, the ranking.
And a bunch of stories in between.
And the good parts. But what do you think could have been different about the documentary? What would you have liked to have seen be done differently or added in or taken out?
More footage, longer story, more parts. That's what I'd like. Like as a fan, you know, like it was three parts and it was 7 hours. But I remember watching an interview of Peter Jackson talking about making it, and like he made it at his house,
mm-hmm.
you know, in his studio with multiple people.
Yeah.
But he was like, we would take things out and then we're like, oh, this doesn't fit right. We need to put this back in. And then the further that we got into all of the film that we watched, there were just so many good parts. We couldn't take them out. Mm-hmm. So we ended up, it was supposed to be a 2-hour film and we ended up pushing it to 7 hours. Right.
They had to ask
Paul and Ringo for permission. And they said, yeah. Well, they saw it too.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, wow, I don't remember that. That's fun. I was like, yeah. Well, there's a lot of drinking too.
Oh, I saw when they were writing. There was a few scenes there.
Yeah, like I think it was in part two, like halfway part through part two, where they were writing songs and stuff, and they added the piano player. I can't remember his name. The fifth
Billy Beatle. Preston.
Yeah, Billy Preston, and he's a phenomenal piano player.
Oh yeah, but he's so good.
Out of all the things though, that's basically all. I wouldn't change anything about it. I would just add more footage and audio.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like it to be like a 4-part or a 6-part or something like this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it would devalue it any less. If anything, it'd probably make it even better, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it was great, but the reason why I gave it a 9 out of 10 was I think it glossed over a lot of things that could have been focused on. I know that he didn't want to focus too much on the issues, the dynamic issues, but I think there are certain things, and there's a few criticisms of it that are also saying the same thing. It's like it didn't mention the fact that John was addicted to heroin. I think it kind of glossed over a lot of those things and kind of repeatedly played the same songs, and I know that that's part of it, but I like that he was showing the moments where they're writing the songs.
Yeah.
The constant jams, like the full jams. I understand he's trying to show the evolution of the song.
Yeah.
But you could show that in moments. And I think that instead of doing that, what I would have done is focused more on the in-between and the moments where they're talking and the dynamics there, which are the most important part of it for me. And it was great and everything, but that's the only thing I would have changed is the substance of the negative aspects of it. But I think he was well aware of the fact that this was going to be on Disney Plus. So naturally there's a bias
It's got to have some kind of filter on it, but there's also a warning thing too. It's like, it has alcohol and smoking, mm-hmm. and da, da, da. But it's not going to say John Lennon's on heroin.
Exactly. Yeah.
But if you're a Beatles fan and you know, like some Beatles history, you would know during that time that, you could tell in the documentary, like, there's a part where he, like, shows up at lunch. Like, he looks hungover or something. He's like, sorry, I'm late, boys. And they're like, we're about to take a break. He's like, and Paul's like, where have you been? And he's like, oh, I overslept, partied all night. You know?
I think that had a lot to do with why George left, too.
Yeah.
You know, probably, you know, he wasn't about that.
Yeah.
George was so much smarter than those guys
by
comparison. You can just tell.
Not only that, but it must get really frustrating to be someone that's like so creative, but your two best friends have been writing songs longer than you, and they write great songs. But then when you get to a point where Paul's telling you what to do and how to play it, mm-hmm. and then the other one that's supposedly the leader of the band or in control is like showing up late all the time, and you still can't get your input in while it's just one of them.
Yeah.
No wonder why he left.
They barely, at least from the footage we saw, they barely spent any time on George's songs.
Yeah.
They're like, that's good. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Let's play one after 909 for the 1,000th time.
Yeah. I wish there was.
They spent so much time on Get Back and Dig a Pony and I Got a Feeling.
Yeah.
Other one. But the John song. I'm completely, Don't Let Me Down.
Yeah. Don't Let Me Down.
Those songs they spent the most time on.
Yeah, they played two clips of "I Me Mine," which is that was a cool scene, mm-hmm. though, because it was just George playing, and I think Ringo was drumming or he was just observing George mm-hmm. play, showing them this. And he had the whole song like written out.
It was
just
all there.
He just needed the chorus part, "I Need Me Mine" or whatever. But John and Yoko are like waltzing. Dancing, uh-huh. and John's talking to George while he's playing this. He's like, oh, this is great. This is great dance music. Like, I don't know if he's joking or not, but he was right too, because it's like a 1-2-3, 1-2-3.
You're right. I think that that's an example of what I'm trying to say is like, George would show up with a complete song.
Yeah.
Because he probably understood, had he not shown up with a complete song, they would have never spent the time to complete that song. And that in itself is an example of, I think, why George was clearly more intelligent than these guys. Because in order for, and I'm not saying that that Paul and John weren't intelligent, but from a psychological perspective, that if somebody is not challenged by people, they're going to think every decision they make is correct.
Yeah.
And Paul and John, they were probably never denied anything during the period that they were in the Beatles. Everyone was a yes man to them, except for maybe George Martin or one of the other Beatles. But George, on the other hand, everyone outside of the Beatles said yes, yes, yes to him. But when he was trying to make his songs, John and Paul were very tough on him. So he had a sense of friction in his life, and a sense of friction is what really makes a person intelligent. And you can see by the way he behaves, by the way he writes songs,
by the way he's
way more aware of his surroundings.
He's observant.
And he's kind of just past it. The whole time you see, like, this guy is miles ahead of these guys at this point.
He's just scanning the scene.
From my point of view. Yeah. I'm watching this documentary, and the whole time I'm thinking, like, George is, like, looking to have this, like, this umbilical cord cut so he can run, you know?
And he talks about that.
Yeah, he does.
The end.
I really like that part where he's asking John what he should do.
And John is all excited about that manager guy, because he's like, he knows us better than we know each other.
Oh, he was fooled.
Yeah,
because that guy's just telling them, and I don't know, but I'm assuming when I heard that, I was like, this guy's just telling John what he wants to hear.
Yeah, and it worked.
And that's what John likes, because he's been told what he's wanted to hear.
Yeah,
and it's just that this guy is telling them, you know, whoever he was, I can't remember his name. I read about him after I heard this part, and he did actually end up taking the manager position of the Beatles for the last year or so, if I'm not mistaken. And he was just trying to make money, you know, and he knew that the Beatles were a cash cow. Yeah. So he's gonna know about John and what he likes to smoke, because he's trying to make some money.
Yeah.
But he probably, that's the problem with these like young people that get in contracts and stuff. They get shafted because they don't know what to do.
Yeah, and they see it just like as an opportunity, not a shafting.
Exactly.
You're like, this would never happen. This has never happened to me.
And it never happened to them before, I think, either, when Brian Epstein was still alive, which is, you know, also they talk about that, like when Brian was around, you know, they never dealt with these things like ambiguity and like decision making, because Brian Epstein clearly made the best decisions for them.
Yeah.
And because the band fell apart after that.
Yeah. They were trying to figure out what to do, but they were clashing. It was like Clash of Clans with each other. And they all had different paths they were trying to go down.
Do you think they would have stayed together for longer if Epstein was still alive?
Yeah.
I think so.
It was cool seeing George Martin there.
Oh, my God. George Martin was my favorite part of the whole thing. He's so cool.
He's like, oh, let me come in here real fast, Paul. I was like, why don't you try this? I feel like he's just a very soft-spoken person, or he's seen the evolution of these boys.
He's there from day one.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, at least from the studio days on.
Yeah. And it's probably just a trip for him now. He's like, oh, these boys are wearing fur jackets and writing.
Yeah.
Get back.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, you know, he saw them from Please Please Me.
Yeah.
Recording Love Me Do. And now they're, wearing these funny coats and polka dot, you know, button downs.
Red raincoats.
He's just like, they've evolved and he doesn't like really say much because he knows that.
He knows who they are.
Who they are, and that anything he would add would only just maybe even get in the way of what they're already going to do. And I'm sure he knew that long before documentary.
I feel like also he was a icebreaker between them when arguments would start boiling up. Like, I feel like he'd step in. Like, he seems like that type of person.
Yeah, for
sure. I don't know.
He is older than them.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of like,
that's what used to happen in the past too.
Yeah,
I've read about that.
It's like Mr. Rogers and the Beatles that can play. That's what I got from
even
it.
He was so young in this.
I know.
I mean, you look at him, he's probably in his 30s, late 30s. He's like the best dressed person there.
Yeah, I know. I was like, this guy's dressed like Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
He's so cool.
Yeah.
What do you think was unexpected? Like, what did you not expect to see?
Well, you know the rumor, it's like, oh, Yoko broke up the band or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like there was a lot more tension with Paul McCartney and the rest of the three Beatles than there was with Yoko.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, that's what you're told. It's like a rumor, you know? But then when you see this, she's just sitting there, like, being respectful.
Yeah.
And then, like, there was one time, though, where, like, Paul and Yoko and I think John was playing drums. And they were all just jamming, and Yoko was yelling into a mic, but she was invited into it. It's not like she was walking up to the mic. Like,
it was clearly that they were just killing time.
Yeah, because
the
other two weren't there. And sorry, can you repeat the question one more time?
What was unexpected? But before you go on, I want to say, that the whole Yoko Ono being the reason why, and just this this mean lady. I think the expression for that is a harridan.
I think this documentary debunked that.
Yeah, exactly. Theory. That was a media generated narrative. I don't believe that to be true. You know, the media has to write about something.
Yeah.
And especially in the 60s where, you know, the feminist movement hadn't even taken off yet. I think that happened in the 70s.
Yeah.
Like the second wave, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, there was a hatred. There still is a hatred for women, but there was definitely a hatred for women in that time.
Yeah.
And she was a scapegoat for, you know,
she was the answer to
this band's breakup. Yeah. Anyway.
I think the thing that threw me off the most, though, was the tension that all of them had with Paul.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Throughout the whole entire process. Control of writing songs, control of telling people what to do in the band, control of making decisions, but not like talking to all of them immediately, you know. That also resided with John too, but I feel like John was a lot more, I feel like Paul was just like trying to prove himself in a way to John, but in a position of power like that, I feel like John held it together a lot better than Paul did.
I agree.
Like when it comes to
that, might have been the heroin.
Probably. He was very calm.
He seemed more calm than you would think, right?
But, you know,
I don't know if that is. I'm just speculating.
And another thing, too, is when they were writing songs and they were just being goofy and like basically just fucking off and like drinking and smoking and cracking jokes and Doris gets her oats and all these things, you know, but they were making progress in songs still. Like, it's crazy to me to see like how unorganized some certain parts were, but how much progression of songwriting got done.
Yeah,
that was the most shocking thing.
That was shocking to me too. Like, the second episode starts and they're playing I Dig a Pony, and I'm like, when did they write this? They didn't even play it in the first part.
Yeah,
so that was really strange.
Yeah,
and they all knew how to play it. So it's like, when did they sit and learn that riff?
It's a part of that 150 hours that should have been in that eight-part document. It's parts
should
like,
have included that.
Yeah. It's parts like that, though.
You spent too much time showing moments where Paul and John were just dicking around and like doing ridiculous things. And those were great to see, but I mean, I actually even skipped a lot of that in the second because it was like
dragging
watching
on.
Two emotionally unevolved children or men acting
young
like
men.
Children. And I was like, this is kind of like, it's great because these guys are like, you know, were my heroes. They are my heroes still. I don't really have a hero complex with anybody anymore. I try not to, I should say. But it's like, I don't want to, I don't know. It's not that I don't want to see that, but also I don't want to see that because I hold these guys in very high esteem.
Yeah.
And
it's like, welcome to the life of George Harrison.
What I noticed, one take I had was when I was watching it, exactly, I felt like George in the corner because George is sitting there criticizing these guys, not in a judgmental way, but he's just like, come on.
Can we write the song?
There's so much unwillingness to get in a vulnerable state with their dynamic. Like, they're so unwilling to get into conversations that are not beyond the surface that they cannot stop joking, it seems.
Yeah.
Like that's a kind of like a psychoanalysis, but
yeah.
I mean, every moment somebody is silent or every moment that there is like something that may be said that's serious, John or Paul crack a joke about it. It's just like they're unwilling.
It's like a defense
to
mechanism.
Be exactly. They're unwilling to be vulnerable. And that is very evident in why George walks away.
Yeah.
And even Ringo, you know, he was really quiet a lot of the time,
too. I think that part that you're talking about, though, that you skipped over was like right after George left.
Yeah. So what you were saying, it was right after?
It was right after George left. So I feel like they didn't know what to do with themselves because he actually walked out. He's like, I'll see you at a pub somewhere sometime. Or, mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It was in that. And then part two at times.
They're like trying to get him back.
Yeah.
Still. And they're having problems trying to get him. They tried three times, I think, two or three times to go convince George. And he didn't come back until it was like on his terms.
Yeah. You know? That's good. The whole TV show nonsense, they would have never been able to pull it off. It wouldn't have been good.
Yeah, no, and that's another thing too. They kept pushing the date like another week.
They had no idea what they were doing. They had no idea.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like it just seems like one giant clusterfuck, mm-hmm. but something great came out of it.
For sure.
Which is pretty amazing in itself.
I was going to say, instead of putting a lot of the things, or as the Beatles, not in terms of the documentary, but in that moment, instead of joking so much, they could have spent some time on George's songs.
Yeah.
That's what they should have done.
Yeah.
But who am I? I was not in that band.
I was surprised that they didn't do that, but I feel like they kind of did. Like, I don't think I Me Mine would have been on the album if George didn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's a good song. But I don't know if that's true or not. That's just,
John didn't even play on that song.
Not John. I said George.
I know. But John didn't play on that song.
Yeah.
So if I'm not mistaken, I'm going to look this up.
But
in
just
a second,
letting the song itself that George wrote be on the album.
Yeah. He muscled his way in it by leaving.
Yeah. By leaving. Yeah. I don't think it would have been on there if not. And I don't know. There was footage of him playing Old Brown Shoe.
Yeah.
And that was great. And then he was like trying to play the piano and he couldn't figure it out. And then the other guy came. What's his name again? The piano
Billy
player.
Preston.
Billy Preston, yeah. He's a great pianist.
Definitely. I was going to say, if I'm not mistaken, John wasn't on the recording of I Mean Mine. And that in itself says something. Like, he didn't even want to bother being on one of the recordings for some reason. So you see a lot of the happy moments. But why didn't they show why George wasn't there while they were getting the final recording of I Me Mine? It's a three-piece, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. I will look this up.
Yeah.
We should take a quick break, though. And then I want to ask you about the songs on the record. Let's talk about that a little bit. And among other things.
Sounds good.
We are back on Our Thoughts Tonight, and I did fact check myself on the
I Me Mine, George Harrison.
I Me Mine, and whether John played on it or not, and he didn't. He wasn't in the studio, I believe, when they were... he didn't play on it, and I guess, this was a problem, obviously, for George.
Yeah, when George presented it to them at what's the place called?
Twickenham, something like that.
Twickenham.
I don't know.
Wimbledon, whatever. Some weird.
It was Twickenham. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, when George presented it to them at Twickenham, we talked about this earlier. John was waltzing with Yoko because he had no interest in it at all.
No. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
That's kind of sad.
So in terms of the album, let's pull up the album. Let It Be.
Let Her Be. Let Her Be. Let Her Be.
In terms of the album, what song would you say is the best song on the album? And what song would you say is the worst? We have two of us, Dig a Pony, Across the Universe, I Mean Mine, Dig It, Let It Be, and Maggie May.
I don't even think Dig It is a song.
No, it's like
a
50 second long interlude.
Interlude, yeah. And watching
side two is I've Got a Feeling, One After 909, Long and Winding Road, For You Blue, and Get Back.
Man, that's hard. Mm-hmm. Like on the first side, I like three of those songs like immediately. It's I Dig a Pony, Across the Universe, and What was the one, other one? I'm trying to remember. Two of Us.
Yeah, Two of Us is...
Those are my three favorite songs on this whole album.
So Dig a Pony, Two of Us, and which one? I Got a Feeling?
Yeah. No, not I Got a Feeling. It was...
I've Got a Feeling!
I Got Dementia. I can't remember
so
what I said.
Two of Us, Dig a Pony, Across the Universe?
Yeah, Across the Universe.
Yeah, those are the first three on the album.
Yeah, and I like those three songs.
Yeah.
My least favorite song, Let It Be. Overplayed.
100%.
Overshadowed every single song on that album.
Every song on the album. I can't stand that
and
song.
And you can see the boredom in George's eyes, and John's laying down on Yoko Ono's lap.
Yeah.
He's like, when do I come in? I only got two chords. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Ringo just looks like he's about to fall asleep, and he's like asking someone for a drink while John's like playing Let It Be over and over and over and over again. And they look like they're losing their minds. In George's eyes, he's like, I came back for this shit. Because this is after he...
Seriously, it's a boring song.
He doesn't
song.
Say it, but it's
the
slow.
Progression is bored.
And
the lyrics are sentimental in a really lame way.
I don't think it's a bad song.
No, it's a phenomenal song, but
it's
boring.
It's a beautiful song. I love it when I first heard it when I was like 9. But I've heard it overplayed so many times. Like, I'd rather hear Maybe I'm Amazed by Paul McCartney. I'd listen to that song on repeat.
Maybe I'm amazed.
Yeah. But I can't listen to Let It Be. Like, whenever I listen to that album, I'd skip Let It Be.
Same. Every time. Yeah. I would say my least favorite is Let It Be.
It's funny because that's the name of the album.
Yeah. My favorite, I would have to say, is The Long and Winding Road.
Yeah,
which is like, if you were to take Let It Be and make a more interesting song, you'd get The Long and Winding Road.
The Long and Winding Road is a phenomenal song. It's like a masterpiece.
Yeah. And that's funny because I used to say for years that was my least favorite Beatles song. And then one day I heard it in a different way.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? This is so good.
Yeah.
And I think what turned me off from that song was the Phil Spector mix.
Yeah.
Because the version I heard was from that Beatles movie Yesterday.
Yeah.
And that version was, you know, a stripped down version of it without the stupid horns and all the bullshit. And that changed it for me. Not even the Paul version, but then I went back and listened to the Paul version without the horns and on the Let It Be Naked.
And he didn't even like the horns and stuff. He didn't want it in there.
Mm-mm. No, he didn't. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was a lawsuit regarding that mix.
You write a beautiful song and then they just put a bunch of horns over it.
It's bullshit.
Yeah. Just let the man and his piano play. You don't need 50
Seriously.
Horns.
Seriously. That's one other thing I noticed is like, you know, when we were in a band, I was kind of like the Paul figure in a sense because I was always kind of driving the songwriting.
Yeah.
But
what
the only reason
do?
Was because nobody else was going to do it.
Yeah.
Not you, because when we start writing the songs, you would jump in and add to things. But you were the drummer.
Yeah.
So in terms of like riffs, the other two guys didn't say shit.
I have the option to just sit there and be like, okay, what are we going to play? And then when you're like, you can play now, we'll figure something out. Just play in this time signature.
Yeah.
You know, then I do it. But then I start experimenting.
Exactly.
That's my job.
Or you're like, hey, we should try this instead or whatever. Like you would add to it because you weren't composing any of the riffs.
Yeah.
But you had ideas nonetheless. These guys in our band, they would just stand there like statues. They would play the riffs. They would play the songs, but they just stand there with no ideas.
It's like every now and then.
Occasionally.
He would have an idea. But.
And I'm not trying to be critical of them, but I am.
It's hard.
At the same time,
it's hard to write songs as a band when you're like the focal point. Like, we all show up to school and you're essentially the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So when Paul is saying that essentially to George, where he's like, "Look, I keep trying to tell you this, but you just keep responding in a way that's like invalidating to me. Like, give me something.
Yeah,
you're not saying anything." They just kind of like stare at Paul, but he's like, "Well, what do you think? Should we do this? Should we do that?"
Yeah.
They're like invalidating.
Yeah.
So of course Paul is going to be like, "Play this because you're not doing anything for me."
Yeah.
So play this, otherwise we're not going to get anything done today.
Yeah.
And then we're gonna leave. And oftentimes, if nothing gets done, it's probably him that gets blamed or something.
Yeah.
So, or he fears that at least.
And that's when George walked off.
That's when George walked off. But I was totally on the side of Paul in that argument.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. And the rest of the documentary I thought was kind of weird. you were reading earlier a review where it focused more on the songs of Paul and how they wrote Paul's songs. And I thought, like, there are moments where Paul's sitting on the piano and he's, you know, playing these songs for the people that are always around the band. And they're just like, their eyes are like glossed over, like puppy dogging to this guy. And yeah, it's Paul McCartney, but he's just a human being.
Yeah.
And they kind of like, you know, metaphorically suck his dick, you know?
Yeah. Put him on a pedestal.
They put him on a pedestal and he's eating it up. Like, you know, he's playing all these different songs and he's talking about his songs. And to me, it came off kind of narcissistic, personally. I don't know if that was the context, but in the context that it was shown in the documentary,
that's how it came across to me. Yeah.
And that very, very much could have been true because, you know, he is Paul McCartney. See, now it's sounding like I've got a bad review of this again.
No, it's turning into
McCartney 3 again.
No, no, it's not. Well, I guess that kind of answers that question I was going to say. I was like, which Beatle do you relate to the most in the documentary?
Actually, I don't relate to Paul the
most. Just that
just in that moment, but I relate to George the most through it because maybe in the past days, like when we were in a band, I would have related more to Paul.
Yeah.
But nowadays...
Yeah, like more George.
I'm like standing there like George being critical of these two phenomenal songwriters that are also idiots.
Yeah.
You know,
and his best friends.
It's the classic caricature of, you know, the famous person.
Yeah.
You know, they're these spoiled people.
Yeah.
And they obviously got out of it, or you would think that they got out of it eventually, or their public relations made it look like they've gotten out of that at this point in their lives.
Yeah.
But at that moment in 1968 or 69, they seemed very full of themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you take
not
a step,
George and Ringo.
No, yeah. But if you take a step back.
Step back.
Step back. Get back. Frying pan. No, but if you look, if you're in their old brown shoes. Anyways. But seriously, though, like if you're in their shoes, put yourself in their shoes and you've made as much success as they have and they haven't even hit their 30s yet.
Yeah.
You know, that's I feel like inevitably you would get to a point like that, especially when you're all crossing paths and wanting to do your own things. There's going to be a lot of frustration going on, you know. Paul's motivated and wants to get things done. He just wants to play live again. John's, I don't know. I just want to be with Yoko all the time. George is like, can I get a fucking song in on an album? That'd be nice. Or I'm going to leave the band. And Ringo's,
pretty much.
Ringo's just on the drums like, are we a band still? Like confused, you know?
Yeah.
But he's a phenomenal drummer. I feel like if I was to relate to anybody, it would have to be Ringo.
You think so?
Yeah. Either Ringo or George. Because I'm not Paul. I'm not writing like beautiful melodies on pianos by myself, having people's eyes glossed over, and I'm not John, you know.
Yeah,
I feel like as much as I idolize both those guys and like love those guys, and I've never met them in my life, but I love all the music that they've produced because it's gotten me through a lot of hard times in my life. But I feel like I relate more to Ringo, like as a drummer and being in a band. And being in that position, in that throne, in that chair, just observing, like from bird's nest view, you're just like, what the fuck is going on? And he's silent the most in the whole film.
Yeah.
Like, he's more silent than
Ringo,
George.
Right? Yeah. He says like three things.
Yeah. He's like, I fought it, Paul. You might want to get away.
Yeah.
You know, that's true. He did say that to Paul in part three. Check it out. But, you know.
For sure. Yeah, I agree.
He probably feels the most vulnerable.
Absolutely.
In the whole band. Because just like you said, you're like, he's not writing the songs. He's just playing to them and he's playing what they want him to play. So he's essentially just sitting there waiting for something to form, something to happen.
Exactly.
In order to do his job.
He's almost like a spectator to a certain extent.
Yeah. But yeah, I feel the most connected to him.
So
I relate the most to him.
I'm going to tie this into something that's very true to our thoughts tonight. And, you know, Baudrillard talks about television quite a bit in regard to the hyper-real and the world and consumerism. I mean, it's inextricable from our world and our culture. And he talks about reality TV a bit. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, his criticism of things that are like behind the scenes or things that are like reality TV, it's like we no longer watch TV. The television watches us, because we're in this constant search for real, what's real, you know, for what reason. I can't remember exactly. I don't know. Maybe he does answer why we're constantly in the search, but that's how we seek our fulfillment, is by seeking out reality.
For comfort.
Exactly. But we are in this search constantly confronted with the hyper real. And I think the Beatles Get Back documentary, again, is just, it's another expression of hyper reality, where it's like we're watching these guys, you know, and we don't even know still if this is really how they are in terms of personality, because we're watching a snippet, like such a fragment of their lives.
A month edited each day.
Yeah. 20 minutes each day, pretty much. Yeah. Like if I took 20 minutes of footage of your life every day for a month and edited it all together, do you think that would be an accurate representation of your entire personality?
I don't. Exactly. You can edit it however you want.
However you want. Just like that alone.
Not to like bash on the news or anything, but they can film things.
Bash and, all you want.
Yeah, I know.
They deserve to be bashed on.
You can film things and narrate it however you want to. And whatever you film isn't full shots. It's only snippets of it. And you can create your own narrative by the things you say and the shots that
and
you
and what
have.
You leave out.
It's very easy to do. In. And then you broadcast it on every single TV. And then you got people that are like, questioning it and asking
like the Yoko narrative.
Yeah, exactly. And then you got people that just eat that shit up and they're like, this is the truth. You know, like it's set in stone. It was on the news. I'm like, don't you have a brain? Like, do you think like just because it's on the news, like some things, yeah, show me some factual proof, like that tornado that ran through the states and caused total destruction. I'm going to believe that. Because I saw it and then I fact checked it, you know, and it's sad. It's like, oh, yeah, Merry Christmas. That sucks. But I don't believe everything I hear on the news.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like this has stripped one narrative and added another. It's stripped away the narrative that was made in the Let It Be documentary and the Yoko nonsense. Added a new narrative, whatever that narrative is. I think if we give it some time, we'll probably see what like the general consensus of it is.
Like five more times.
They kind of Disney'd it, you know?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, but at the same time,
I really just don't sound like I'd like this fucking documentary.
No, you do. I know you do. They had to Disney it. It was on Disney Plus. But I don't think they Disney'd it so much. I think they just edited out certain things, like things that you can't say. But I think overall the presentation was like phenomenal, and
I agree.
It was beautiful, just like watching these humans interact. You know, we all have our own opinions and everything, but the whole film itself was like a gift.
Like, I agree.
Something I wish I could have seen with my own two eyes. Like in real life, not hyper reality life, you know.
We're gonna go ahead and do our final thoughts and talk about our final thoughts on the Get Back documentary. Yep. Do you want to start, or should I go first?
You go first.
All right. So my final thought on this was that it was great from a perspective of like a Beatle fan. And somebody that just wanted to watch something entertaining, that it was definitely that. From the perspective of somebody who is like, I guess, like searching the philosophy and phenomenology of this, I think it was a little more honest than the past documentary, but still, you can only get so honest, you know, with media.
Yeah.
And I think that people shouldn't be so quick to clean their narratives of these guys just by this footage that they've seen. They're great, but I think that they have a lot of flaws, and people need to remember
that.
There's
a lot more to show.
Exactly.
That was let on.
There's no reason to create a larger than life thing about these normal guys. And that's what's special about them, in my opinion. My favorite part was watching the late Beatles play early Beatles songs, which is something I've always wanted to see.
Yeah.
And it gave me that. And that's why, you know, one of the main reasons I gave it a 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
That's my final thought.
My final thought is I connected to it on a musical standpoint as a musician, and I got to see things that I hope to see, some things I didn't get to see, but it was just nice having an insight on a day in the life of their lives. And it also inspired me to want to play music more.
Definitely, definitely.
Like, I picked up a guitar right after I finished the film. I was like, I'm going to learn one of these songs, man. Like, it was so good.
Same here.
You know?
We used to play so much music, like, just like them. I mean, that's another thing. Their process reminded me a lot of, like, how we used to jam. Yeah. Even the room they were jamming in kind of looked like your room upstairs at the shop. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is really reminiscent.
Yeah. It spoke to me, though. I loved it. It was great. Well, I think that's it.
All right. Our thoughts tonight. That was a special edition. We'll catch you next time. Our thoughts tonight.
Our thoughts tonight. Oh, to write a song that has no meaning at all, that doesn't touch a personal nerve or heed a social call, that knows no up or down, that has no right or wrong, that doesn't need a reason to waste some time with song, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I'll sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Doesn't let it all hang out, that doesn't wave any flag or have any slogan to shout, that knows no east or west, that has no left or right, that doesn't throw any stones or look for any fight, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just to write a song that won't mend a broken heart, that won't woo you like a lover or promise a brand new start, that doesn't preach of rain and fire or heed any higher call, that doesn't need a reason to mean nothing at all, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa.